The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Solnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, Q&A edition. Coming to you immediately after our nice three-day Labor Day weekend holiday. We are streaming live, as we typically do, on Tuesday afternoons, Mountain Time. Technically, or officially, the time is between 1 and 1:30, but it's pretty much becoming 1:30 every Tuesday afternoon, so... Well, at least we're hitting the window just right before the window closes. So on today's show, the rumor is we're actually going to get caught up on some more of those ancient emails from 2017 that mysteriously reappeared as we were rearranging some papers on our recording studio platform, otherwise known as a giant conference table that was converted into a recording studio. But so we've got that going on. We've got some... I know some Social Security questions and then a variety of other things. So I don't know what the question is from 2017. Hopefully it's actually still relevant today in 2019. But Jim will let us know. How was your weekend, by the way?
The Labor Day weekend wasn't too bad.
That's good.
Did some hiking. And first time hiking since my medical issue. Actually, we probably never talked. I don't think anyone even knows. No. For those who don't know, which is pretty much everyone listening, I have had some medical issues, a little medical scare, I guess one could say, and got the privilege of riding in the back of an ambulance, which is not very common. Have you ever been in an ambulance?
Not as a patient.
Well, when I was a cop, I put many people in an ambulance. That doesn't sound right. I helped... It's not what I meant.
You loaded?
I helped load people into an ambulance. I didn't literally put them in the ambulance. And you don't realize how uncomfortable it is back then. But when I was being rushed to the hospital, they were nice. There were three guys back there in the ambulance, and all three were apologizing about how uncomfortable and bumpy the ride is. In fact, one gentleman, EMT, worded it as, it's like a tank back here. And he went, kidding. Not that I've ever been in a tank. But they are not comfortable. They are not comfortable at all. And I bumped into someone recently, much older than me, well into their late 80s, early 90s. And they were recently in an ambulance, and they were complaining about the uncomfortable ride as well. So I think once you're in
an ambulance... So maybe there's an opportunity there for... someone to create a
I was thinking the same thing. Someone needs to create a much better suspension system on the back of ambulances. But anyways, how the hell do I get on the subject of that?
You were sharing with us your
weekend. Oh, so part of my medical emergency, folks, led to me passing out and falling.
That sounds really serious, but that's all calmed down now,
it's,
right?
It looks a lot better than it did on day one and two and three. They're still doing tests. I have to get a monitor type thing and start wearing it and doing a bunch of other things. But that's neither here nor there. I'm fine. Clients who are listening should have received an email. Don't stop panicking. I'm still here. I'm not going anywhere. I kept thinking, though, in the back of the ambulance, also, there's a lot running through your head when you're being rushed in the back of an ambulance. And they're screaming, by the way, heart attack, heart attack, heart attack. And I'm sitting there
Which it turned out it wasn't.
It wasn't. Right. And that's what I'm saying. Yeah. I'm like, no, right. no heart attack.
Stop saying that.
Exactly. And I would have known if I was having a heart attack. You had all those signs of whatever it is. I don't know what they are, but I wasn't. Compression and pain and... no, I didn't have any of that. I wasn't having a heart attack. But anyways, they did figure out I wasn't having a heart attack, but at the time they were. And then they're trying to rip my shirt off. And you know I like to wear nice shirts from Robert Graham. And
did they rip your Robert Graham
shirt? Oh, my God. I was trying to talk to him to tell him, don't rip the shirt. I was more concerned about this shirt. And he couldn't get the buttons undone. And, of course, my hands were in no position to start undoing the buttons. And that's all that's running through my head is they're going to rip this Robert Graham shirt. Anyone out there who understands Robert Graham, you know his shirts are not cheap. And I felt I was going to be fine. Don't rip the shirt. But anyways, as soon as they got the shirt open and they successfully did
I'm kind of jealous you have shirts by a person. Mine are made by a person too, but it just says number 27.
It's called single, no children, no wife.
Yeah, I get it.
With disposable income, six kids, a wife, and limited disposable income. But anyways, everything worked out well when I got to the hospital, and things are looking around good, except I do have a broken finger, as you can see. Mm-hmm. And the doctor said he didn't think he would have to operate on that if it heals appropriately. Mm-hmm. And I went hiking yesterday to do Hot Lake. I have done Hot Lake every single year, probably for
you
the
last...
You
didn't mess up your finger again, did
I
you?
I fell. I've never fallen. I've hiked that trail at least 10 years in a row. And this time, going up, usually you fall going down. But going up, I fell and barely missed the finger, but I did get a really bad bruise. I don't know what you call it, a bone bruise. Have you ever heard of those?
I have.
Okay.
They're not fun.
They're not fun. And it caused a big welt on the leg. And the good news was, Chris, there was a doctor on the trail when I fell. So when she saw me fall, she came over. Oh, wait a minute. You okay. Oh, well, I don't know what's going on. All of a sudden, everyone is talking. What I'm saying, folks, is after I fell, there just happened to be a physician on the trail who took care of the bone bruise, which caused this big, big welt on my leg. And so yours truly has had some really bad medical things happening lately. I feel like I'm falling apart, but everything seems to be working. And I believe we have a live caller, and that's what Chris is...
It's going to be a couple minutes, so.
Okay.
But we'll do one question first.
All right. Well, I will read a Social Security question that Chris can answer while they're trying to get the caller on the phone. This is one of the smaller ones, and then we'll take that live caller. But anyways, this is Chris from a listener. He does not give his state, but we will, as always, call him George. And he begins, question for Chris, or whatever name Jim happens to be calling him currently. Right now it is Chris. I have called him several names in the past. I've called him Pete, called you Steve. I don't know why. We don't even have a Steve who works here. Called you Piss once, putting your
Nor
name
Nor have
in
you ever had
Chris's
a Steve
together,
right.
Pete's and Chris. But anyways, it says, question for Chris, or whatever name Jim is calling him currently.
Oh, so long-time listener. So.
Regarding claiming for Social Security,
mm-hmm.
I'm 62 and my wife is 66. My benefit at full retirement age will be more than twice what hers will be at her full retirement age. I plan on waiting until 70 to claim my benefits. Can she claim spousal now, or does she have to wait until I file? This is interesting because I know the answer, but I also think this something that I know you're going to say something, and if you don't, I'll
oh, I'm going to say it. Something.
I know so, you know what I'm thinking they should be doing.
I know you know that I know that you know?
Correct.
Got it. So basically, fundamentally, I guess, to record or to receive a spousal benefit, the person on whomsecord you're claiming has to have filed. So in this case, for his wife to claim a spousal benefit on his record, he has to, what I call, unlock the door to the spousal benefit by claiming himself. So if he's not claiming till 70, she will not be able to claim until she's 74 at least a spousal benefit. So the spousal benefit is off limits at this point. However, there is something she can claim right now, and that is her own benefit. She is able to, he said that she did have a benefit, just that his benefit is more than twice hers. So once she is eligible or entitled to receive a spousal benefit, she will want to do that. But in the meantime, she can be collecting her own benefit. So there's no reason for her to wait until that spousal benefit can be turned on. She can claim her own benefit right now. They may as well be collecting something over the next 8 years. He said he was 62, didn't plan to claim until 70. She'll be 74. Now, I'm not judging whether this is the correct strategy overall or not, whether it's wise for him to delay to 70 or not may very well be a great way to go. But we don't have the numbers. We don't know what her benefit is. We have kind of a general comment about it, his being more than twice hers. But without knowing the actual figures, the ages, the earnings record, what he's doing over the next few years, things like that would factor into the optimal claiming strategy. Also, you always want to fit your Social Security claiming strategy into your overall retirement planning picture. So there isn't just one answer for everybody. No matter how simple software might tell you the claiming strategy should be for you. But was that along the lines that you were...
Yeah, that's what I was going to recommend. Now, he did say in this that his wife... is older than him. He's 62. Mm-hmm. She's 66. Mm-hmm. If she claims, and I like the same idea, he's waiting. She cannot get. There's no more file and suspend. And he wouldn't be able to have done that anyways because he was too young, even if that was still around. But I just thought she should wait to her full retirement age. She can't be more than a couple of months from her full retirement age if she's not already there. That way she won't have any small reduction.
Right. So the comment that she is 66 right now, that's going to put her right at the...
Well, what's that year of birth?
55 is the break-off. So if she was born between 55 and 60.
But if she's 66 already... She was born in 1953, so her full retirement age is 66.
She would have it. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So chances are, listener, then your wife's retirement full retirement age is 66 exactly, and not 66 and 2 months or 4 months or 6 months and 8 months, which is what some people have as their full retirement age as they lead up to age 67 being everyone's full retirement age for people born after 1960. If that is the case, then your wife's already at her FRA, full retirement age. She's not going to suffer a loss in any type of spousal benefit when you turn yours on at age 70. I would just turn it on, be paid for waiting.
In fact, she should be filing a retroactive claim to back when she turned 66, at least as far as she can get.
True.
I don't know when exactly. If she turned 66 11 months ago, she won't be able to backdate it quite that far. But
go
there
back
was
6 months.
There was no real benefit to her waiting since she's going to be switching over or getting upgraded to that spousal benefit. you know, not going to make a huge difference in the numbers overall, but 6 months worth of benefits all lumped together, that might buy you a little vacation or something like that. So you'll have to judge whether giving up the little bit of delayed retirement credit that she received on her own benefit is worth it or not. But in my opinion, probably not.
I can guarantee you it wouldn't be worth, because she's going to switch in 8 years to the spousal benefit.
Correct.
You're not going to make that. If they take the lump sum, the 6 months lump sum, they're not going to make that lump sum up in eight years.
No,
not at all.
Correct.
So that's why I would definitely take the back, assuming
the retroactive
retroactive.
Benefits. Yeah.
At least you have to be 6 months past her full retirement age.
No, she doesn't. She could be 1 month past. She just can only file 1 month retroactively.
Oh, yeah, but to
all
six.
No matter how much it is, up to the six she wants to get.
Right. Yeah. What I'm trying to explain to him is, you need to be 6 months past to get 6 months of retroactive benefit. If she's only 2 months past her full retirement age, she'll only get 2 months of retroactive benefits.
Right.
But if she's 7 months past or more, 11 months past is the most she can be without getting another year older, you can only go back 6 months. What Chris and I are trying to tell you, listener, you'll probably end up with more by taking the retro, even though she would give up some of that delayed retirement credit, because in 8 years you're going to switch to a spousal anyways, and it takes, and I've never seen a break even being less than 8 years.
No.
So I can't for the life of me see how you would have been better off not taking the retro as well. And I know you kind of hedged and said, you know, we're not sure if this is the claiming strategy you can do, but if I was a gambling man, I would put my bank on this.
It's more the issue of him delaying all the way to 70.
True. Now, that we don't know, but the size difference between his and
hers. Her claiming now is a pretty much a no-brainer. I can't think of a reason why she wouldn't, but him delaying all the way to 70 may or may not be. I just wanted to put that disclaimer in there because we don't know enough about the whole case to say or to support that necessarily. It may very well be a great way to go. It will, in fact, generate the highest survivor benefit for her if he were to predecease or if either one. So there's the attractiveness of that. But we don't know their health status or a lot of other factors that play into this.
So, all right, I'm content with that answer. I think you covered it adequately enough. Now, do we have a caller, or do I get into this big question?
We do have a caller, and I'm going to get it transferred right now.
Oh, okay.
And
hold
just
on,
take
folks. We have a caller. Chris is doing his techie stuff over here.
I am. I'm calling for the call.
Oh, we're calling him?
No,
her?
I'm calling her. I'm calling for it. I'm telling her to call.
Whatever. Okay.
Exactly. It's very confusing, all this technology.
I know what Dave Ramsey does, it the call is right there. Apparently, we don't have his software.
Because we don't have a... apparently, we need a little more training.
You're making fun of us, staff.
We don't have a... you know, the glass where you just point to them and they have it ready to go. And ours is texting downstairs.
That is true. We are in the attic, for those who don't know. And our staff is 2 floors down. Yeah.
But should be any moment now. The call is going to come in from Texas. We can at least cover that for now. And
do we know the topic?
Deferred income plan is the topic. So I'm guessing some form of deferred compensation plan, but we'll know here shortly. Hi, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show. Thanks for calling in. Can you hear us okay?
Yes, I can.
Excellent. So we're going to refer to you as George. I know you gave your real name to Shauna, but... to keep everybody safe and sound and anonymous, we're going to just call you George, if that's okay.
That's fine.
Excellent. So, George, what is your question? I didn't get a whole lot of detail, but we're open to practically anything you might want to ask.
So, I had been participating for many years in the 401k plan at our company, and this last year in 2018, they sent me notification saying that for all employees that were projected to make an amount above some certain baseline, that they would not be eligible to participate in the 401k anymore, but they would be offering them the ability to participate in a deferred income plan. And it's just something I've never really heard of before. And when that election time came last year, in November of last year, just looking it over, it just sounded like, well, there's some shaky parts to this I don't know about. And I just said, I just elected not to do it. But it's coming back around this year. And I understand the company is matching funds like 50% up to the first 6%. And so that kind of got me interested in saying, well, maybe I better take a look at this. But I wanted to contact you guys to find out what you know about it. If you've had any experience with companies that that put forward a benefit called a deferred income plan.
Can you give me a little bit of info on that rather than just saying a deferred income plan?
Yeah, so it's going to be like a 401k, but it hasn't quite got all the qualifications from an IRS standpoint. And they gave us a little chart that's got the, you know, here's the differences, you know, one versus the other. For instance, type of plan, you know, the 401k is a qualified defined contribution 401k savings plan, whereas the deferred income plan is a non-qualified deferred compensation arrangement.
Okay, yeah. Okay, that's what I needed to see. Okay,
right. Yeah.
So they're putting you into a non-qualified. There's huge differences here. I've never heard, have you, Chris, of where they say if you make more than a certain amount, you
they
have
must be
to
running
it?
Into non-discrimination they, testing
right.
issues with the 401k.
That's
so
what I'm guessing.
It's going to be top heavy, and they decided instead of dealing with that in another way and keeping everyone within the plan, they set up an alternative for those that were weighing down the top end, if you will, of the 401k
plan
itself.
Does your employer, you don't have to give away anything about who you work for, do they have a lot of lower paid workers relative to, say, who would be the higher paid workers?
Could be. I am not exactly sure. It's a good sized company, though, so you would think there'd be some spread.
Yeah, yeah. But a non-qualified deferred compensation plan or deferred income plan, as you're calling it, is going to have there's a lot of differences. And the key is non-qualified. So they are allowed to discriminate with that. Hence, it's being offered only to certain employees and not to others. But your benefit is not squirreled away separately like your 401k is. And enjoying all this ERISA protection, Employee Retirement Income Security Act, the law in the 1970s that protects retirement accounts. And a non-qualified deferred compensation plan is open to the creditors of your employer. So if something was to happen to your company, you could theoretically lose a lot of that compensation that's being deferred. Also, the payouts are sometimes very quick and very strict. In other words, you've got to close it within 2 years, 5 years, 10 years with massive payouts.
And the ramifications of that are you essentially have, if you've listened to the show much, you're aware of what we call the tax planning window, which is the period between when you're receiving your income. We call it, you know, forced income. It's coming to you every single month, every single year as you're working. And then the window is open from the point where that stops until you get income forced upon you again when you have Social Security and RMDs in particular kick in later on. This is another form of forced income recognition. And if you've got a lot deferred, I've seen people have massive distributions out of these plans over a 5 to 10 year period that completely destroys any tax planning they're able to do and you know, forces you into higher tax brackets than you otherwise could enjoy.
I'm not 100% certain that it is a non-qualified deferred compensation plan or not, because you didn't use that verbiage.
Well, the description he read
It sounds it, but
pretty close.
What I would want to do is get that sheet that he has and actually send it. I don't want to say who the person's name is, but he's an ERISA attorney that I know. Mm-hmm. Have him look at that and say and tell me, hey, is this what I think it is? Or is there yet something else that in 21 years I've never heard of until this phone call? And this is one of those plans. He'll know. Mm-hmm. This gentleman will know.
Right.
So I'm just kind of guessing of what you may have, but I'm going to ask, and I don't see these often, but is the numbers 457 used anywhere that you can see, 457?
Not that I can see anywhere.
Okay, because sometimes, Chris, you can get into a private 457 plan, and I don't know if that's what he would have, which is a little different, but not nearly as flexible as a 401k. Yeah.
For how much longer will you be at that employer, do you suppose?
Target is about another 8 years.
Hmm. So it could be quite a bit of
deferral. I've put in about 20.
Yeah. In order, George, to honestly tell you what we think you should be doing, we have to really look on there anywhere on there. Does it say what your payout options are?
Well, it says paid to employee according to the distribution election, cannot roll over into an IRA or other qualified plan. Distribution amount is subject to ordinary income taxes.
But it doesn't describe the distribution
schedule.
Does not. There was some mention of something about 5 years or 3 years or whatever. Oh,
yeah.
They try to make it sound like, you know, you could start drawing on this earlier than.
Yeah, I'm 90% certain you are describing a non-qualified deferred compensation plan, which I can't say I'm overly thrilled with them, only because all what you're doing is deferring compensation. They're putting a little bit extra in there for you. They're not guaranteeing any sort of growth. You don't get to quote-unquote invest it like you do a 401k and see how much of a balance it grows to and defer taxation. They're telling you right off the bat you can't move it into an IRA or another 401k. It doesn't have any of that. It's just income. And when you start receiving it, it might blow up your tax planning window. It might just start throwing out all this income. Now, is that necessarily a bad thing?
Maybe not.
Tax planning, right. Tax planning window may not be important to you. And you may use that as a bridge between retirement and some other point where maybe you start using your regular, I don't want to say, well, regular in the sense of your 401k, your IRA, all of those savings you have. Maybe you start collecting that later or just, I don't know because I don't have a clear picture of you, but I'm not trying to make it sound like, oh, God, no, we hate those. Don't do it. But one of the things you're definitely going to have to find out from your employer is what is the payout schedule? How far after you retire does it have to be fully drained? And the mere fact that you might be able to take some out earlier, especially if you're drawing your regular salary, that's not going to help you. It's just going to push you into a higher income tax bracket. So you should also, when you decide if you want to do this, George, look at what your plan for retirement is. And do you need, you know how we talk a lot on the show about bucketing, which is all about spending and positioning your assets to be spent. Look at that deferred comp plan as a bucket. And you could position it, because I don't think you're going to be allowed to really defer it much longer after you retire, but it could be, Chris, a bucket to be spent initially if he doesn't really have a tax planning opportunity when he first retires.
Or if the window is very long, it's open for a long time. Maybe if you're retiring fairly early at 57, 58, it might be ideal to fund the first 3 years or so. And then your tax planning window opens up for the rest of those years before 70. So there's a lot of variables here. I think you're doing a good thing, which is looking into it so you fully understand what you're getting into. A lot of people just take it and start putting money in there and deferring it, and then suddenly they're shocked when the situation when they retire isn't as rosy from a tax situation as they were hoping. So it's good that you look into it now before you're fully committed on that and look at alternatives. If they're putting money in for you, it's going to be hard to turn down their money. But make sure you understand all the important variables here before you
decide. To me, the important ones are going to be it's most likely subject to the creditors of your employer. Mm-hmm. So just bear that in mind. I'm not saying your employer is going to go out of business, but bear that in mind. It is subject to the creditors. That's what gives it, by the way, its non-qualified status. The fact that it is available to the creditors is one of the elements a non-qualified deferred comp plan needs. And the other thing I would want to know is its payout schedule. Does it have to be closed? I can all but guarantee you it needs to be closed during a certain time period. What is that time period? I've seen 3 years to as long as 10 years. Right. It's not to say a 1 year and a 20-year one don't exist. Unless there's a law against it, I'm not a deep expert in non-qualified deferred comp plans. But the ones I have seen usually pay out between 3 and 10 years.
Yeah, that's what I've seen too.
And it could work beautifully, George, as part of your spending strategy early in retirement, or it could be an albatross that ruins any type of tax planning window. Or if you were going to try to qualify, here's where a lot of our clients get burned on it, George. You're trying to qualify for ACA premium tax credits early in retirement before Medicare begins at 65. So on paper, you need to look poor. You can have millions in an IRA. We do this all the time. We got clients with millions, and the idiotic federal government is picking up 80% of their health care expense because on paper, their tax return, they look poor because the tax return only looks at income. So we can manipulate their income throughout the year by spending bank money or basis from investment accounts. Or we have other people who have taken out HELOCs, lived off of a HELOC for a year or two before they retire. They take out the HELOC, live on that for a couple of years, which is non-taxable, and then the government picks up their health care expense. When they turn 65, we take a massive amount out of their IRA, pay off the HELOC, and they got free health care. What I'm saying is start looking at where this deferred comp plan and its mandatory income payments over a set schedule are going to impact you. To me, that's the big decision. And if it looks like it's going to cause more harm than good, you may not want to do it. But if it looks like it's going to be neutral or actually be a benefit, then I think you should do it, recognizing the biggest risk. It is an asset that is available to creditors of your employer if they ran into financial difficulties.
What if the employer just sold the business? Would it be at risk then or no?
Well, I'm not an expert on these, but selling a business doesn't put it at risk. But if the business that it's sold to goes under, that puts it at risk. It is not squirreled away like a 401k in a separate account with your name on it, protected by the federal rule called ERISA, where bankruptcy and creditors can't get at your 401k. This has no protections whatsoever, and it can be accessed by creditors of your employer, and you got to keep that in mind.
Gotcha.
But it's not, and there's a lot of people listening to us who have these. I know because I've spoken to people in the past who have these, and I know they listen to our podcast. We it's not that Chris and I don't like non-qualified deferred compensation plans. You just have to see where they fit in, and most of the employees are comfortable with that risk. They like their company. They don't feel they're in any type of danger. But we just have to disclose to people this is a risk. To me, one of the biggest risks. But also the limited payout and how that's going to fit into your early retirement years needs to be determined. I have bumped into people who have hired us at this firm, and you know, Chris, we start crunching the numbers and doing a retirement plan for them, noticing they have a 3-year, 5-year, 10-year payout, and it just devastated the ability to get ACA premium tax credits and do any tax planning, and they're just being bombarded with this income. Makes a wonderful early bucket 1/2, so to speak, but ruins tax planning.
And on one hand, it is a beautiful problem to have.
Yes.
Income coming in at such large amounts that you have to pay taxes. So there, we have to always recognize that's the glass half full part, right? It's better to have that income and taxed than not have it at all. So, it's as far as your decisions on, and I don't know what alternatives you might have to participating in it. You may not have a lot of choices, it would definitely be worth looking at if you can control how much gets deferred. It may not be great to defer a ton in there if you're going to create tax problems for yourself.
Yeah, I'm just looking at what I have to put in to get the maximum company match. Really, I'm not going to put a whole lot in.
Yeah, and again, a match is a tough thing to turn down. You'd have to have a really, really pessimistic outlook on taxes and other related ACA credits and things for you to turn down free money. That's kind of how I refer to it. They're offering to pay you more, and if you don't take it, you're turning down that raise. It's kind of a form of that. But yeah, if it's I wouldn't blindly just load the thing up without considering the things we've mentioned here.
Okay. Very good.
Well, thanks a lot for calling, and anything else comes up, please let us know.
Thank you. Okay. Appreciate it, guys.
Thanks, George. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Interesting. That was an interesting question.
I don't think we've tackled anybody on the show that's been kind of kicked out of their 401k because of restructuring at the company, and they're in a higher
category.
Well,
that's why I asked. There's got to be a lot of low-compensated employees who are not participating. Yeah. And for those who don't understand, 401ks have to pass a series of tests every year to make sure that the 401k is not benefiting highly compensated employees or business owners at the expense of everyone else. Right. And this is telling me this company is not passing.
Right, they're failing the test. Yeah.
So they're just saying, well, the hell with it. If you make more than this much, you're not in this.
Right.
That'll allow them to make passing these discrimination tests easier. And so they're saying, here, we're going to give you this non-qualified deferred compensation plan instead. We're allowed to discriminate with that, hence the name non-qualified. We can discriminate with that with our lower paid employees who are not participating. If I knew the business owners or at least the decision makers on the retirement board, they might have tried to actually increase participation amongst lower paid workers as opposed to just telling higher paid workers you're out.
One would think that they crunched those numbers and realized maybe it was going to cost the company more money that they didn't want to pony up to.
The way to do it is just start matching the lower paid people.
Start matching
more.
Or safe harbor approach or something like that. Yeah.
They might have had too many employees for Safe Harbor. I don't think you can have more than 100 employees for Safe Harbor 401k, but I could be wrong on that.
There's a variety of ways to solve the discrimination issue.
Yeah.
They decided to kick the high end out. Right.
But you're right. I'm sure they went through all of that.
One would think, yeah.
And realized, hey, it's not going to work. We got to do it this way. But there's a lot that happens with 401ks, folks, behind the scenes that most people don't even know about, and this is one of them. And those deferred comp plans, which is I'm 90% sure that's what he has without actually seeing what documents he was given. But you just really need to look at how they impact, because I don't want to try to put a percentage on this, Chris, but I think you would agree a lot of people who we do retirement analysis for who have a deferred comp plan end up, I don't want to say regretting it, but often remarking, this isn't going to be as good as I thought.
It takes a little of the shine.
All
off
that
of it, yeah.
income coming in such a short time period really reduces a lot of the flexibility they were looking for.
An income is great if you need it. If you have other resources and you don't need it at the time, then it's better to be able to control when you recognize it, to be able to control your tax story. That's the key here. When you're forced to take income, if you're going to take it anyway because you need it, it's no harm.
It's a good point.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. But if you're being forced to recognize it, and this is where people get into trouble with RMDs, It's income forced upon you whether you need it or not. If you were going to take it out anyway, nobody worries about RMDs because you're taking out the amount or more every single year just to live on because you need to do it. But there's a lot of people who have deferred so long, they have all of this built-up tax consequence that finally is forced upon them starting at 70 and a half. And it's something that they didn't maybe think of as they were making earlier decisions. And, you know, we're part of our mission here is to make sure people look at that, particularly as they approach their tax planning window, in that window that may or may not, depending on your circumstances, open up between in salaried income, income from work, or even self-employed income, and 70 and a half when those RMDs start. You have all the flexibility in the world then to decide where you harvest the money upon which you're going to live, and also maybe do conversions, which is a, you know, kind of side a second tier to that strategy, but definitely worth looking at, because once the ship has sailed, you're looking in the, you know, you're looking back, you can't access your tax planning window anymore. That it's done, and you can't look back and think, oh my gosh, I'm sitting here at 75 recognizing all this income at these high tax rates when I could have recognized it when I was 68 and paid a lot lower taxes.
Right. But he does have to weigh, and you made a very good point to him, he does have to weigh, what is he giving up? I don't know what the quote-unquote match is, which really isn't a match. They're just putting in, well, it's kind of a match, but they're just putting in income that's deferred. Mm-hmm. And when you take it out, you're going to pay taxes on it. Are they giving you 5%, 6%, 10%? You got to look at how much they're putting in compared to what you might give up by getting this income. And to me, the big one is the ACA. The ability to limit your Roth conversions, that could be an issue. It's a tough call. But the big one is if you were going to try for ACA premium tax credits, because that can save, especially if you're a married couple, each of you, $1,000 a month easily. And you're talking some real dollars here on that ACA premium tax credit. Yeah. That this deferred comp plan may cost you. So if they're going to end up giving you a few thousand dollars and it's going to cost you several thousand dollars, if not tens of thousand dollars in premium tax credits later, it's not worth it.
Right.
It's not worth it.
Right.
My take. Okay. Anyone else called?
Not yet.
Not yet. All right. Well, this is a question from 2017. I told listeners last week or the week before, I can't remember now, that I found. Well, I didn't find. Oh, that's how it also came up. The blue folder that was found came about when Laura used the time that I was dying in the hospital. Nobody knew if I was going to see another day.
She was getting your affairs in order.
Right. She was cleaning my arm. She cleaned the under my desk. I felt like I used to feel coming home as a teenager. My mother had cleaned my room. And everything that I knew where it was now put somewhere that made sense to Mom, but clueless to me. Mm-hmm. That's how I felt when I got back in the office out of the hospital. Everything was, it looked nice, but I had no idea where anything was, especially in my office. And there was a certain piece of paper that I had to the right of my seat is where I throw stuff I'm going to take home with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I had put a scrap piece of paper that I had literally, it would have made no sense to anyone but me. And it was three questions I needed to ask Ed Slott.
Mm-hmm.
And I just left it there. And when I came back, it was gone. Uh-oh. Well, she admitted, she said, oh, I saw that. It was gobbledygook. I threw it away.
Oh, no.
Uh-huh. I was like, what do you mean you threw it away? That those were three questions I had to ask Ed and all this excitement of nearly dying.
You're being a little dramatic now.
I can't remember what those three questions were. And then I mentioned what one of the words was. It was the pre-87 call. Mm-hmm. I said, in fact, one was something about pre-87. Remember we had that call a couple weeks ago?
Yep.
And she looks at me and she goes, pre-87? I says, yeah, it said pre-87. And there was other things. She said, I didn't throw that away. I put it in the recycle bin. And boom, off she goes. And she starts thumbing through that big recycle bin we have. Mm-hmm. She found it.
Oh.
Took her a while.
Kudos to her.
And she found it.
So her her reward for cleaning your office was you forcing her to dumpster dive for some random piece of paper.
Pretty much.
Well, that'll teach her to clean your office.
But during the cleaning of the recording studio, mm-hmm. which literally is in the attic, mm-hmm. Chris just accumulates junk listeners.
Oh, stop.
And he's terrible. You know how he goes on and on and on? Well, it's mm-hmm. the same thing. He refuses to throw things away. So this desk was just overfilled. It wasn't my stuff, mind you. It was all his. Mm-hmm. And apparently under said pile of junk, which he kept pushing towards my side of the desk so it looked like it was all of mine, but it wasn't. It was really his. Under there was a blue folder that she found marked questions to answer, which emails to answer, which I thought was a really nice thing, from 2017 and 2018. So we decided we would tackle one of these a week until this... Okay. Blue folder is gone. Okay, this question is 3 pages long. It has got to be one
Whoa.
Of the... Yeah, I'm not going to read it all. Okay. It was one of our longest. Not the longest. The longest is still in said folder. 6 pages. That one, I guess 2017 was a year where people liked writing.
I think that's before we made the announcement, don't send us 3 to 6 page questions. Too much detail.
Yes. So we'll get to that 6 page one of these days. But this is a 3-page one.
Mm-hmm.
So it begins, and where the hell is he from? Ah, Indiana.
Oh, heartland.
The heartland of America, yes. It was sent November 17th, 2017. It begins, Dear Jim and Chris, I hope you can answer this really fast.
And then he sent us 3 pages?
No, I'm just, oh. I made that part up.
Okay.
My name is, and he gives his real name, but then he wrote, but you can call me George if you prefer, and we prefer.
We prefer.
So he says, my name is George. I've been listening to your podcast for a few months. Hopefully he's still listening.
I don't know. We didn't treat him well. Ignored his pleas for help.
I have enjoyed your show, and especially like it when you get into some of the more specific details of retirement. This email will be pretty long. He is right on that. Hopefully not so long you just ignore it. Wow.
We had a premonition.
I think so. And for the record, I did not ignore it. It was put in this really nice blue folder.
To draw attention to it.
Exactly.
But then the folder got lost.
And then Chris just kept flooding this table with more stuff, and it got buried. I will be 35 in 2018.
So oh, well, he's got plenty of time before he
he's
retires.
Only 36
now. I don't feel bad now at all.
So I may be younger than much of your audience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in preparing for an early retirement. And by mm-hmm. early, I mean before 59 and a half,
mm-hmm.
when my retirement assets can be freely accessed. And certainly, before... any Social Security age. So I'm guessing he's talking somewhere in his early 50s he wants to retire, and he's only... Well, when he wrote this, he was 34. He's now 36, probably going on 37. I would very much enjoy listening to a show in which you discuss these topics. Okay, well, here it is. Okay, and I'm going to skip 2 pages worth of his... details. It's really a lot of stuff on what he has,
mm-hmm.
and let's get into some of the questions. Okay. He wants to know one of his basic questions. Should he, because he lists, he is contributing $5,500 to his Roth IRA, which now is probably
$6,000,
mm-hmm. To a Roth IRA, and $5,400 into a brokerage account,
mm-hmm.
as well as contributing the max, I believe he says the max, to his traditional IRA. But now he's able...
You mean traditional 401k?
Excuse me, traditional 401k.
Okay, because yeah, he can't do
right.
fully max a Roth and a traditional.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. He's filling up all 3 buckets. Always
correct.
Taxable,
that's
maybe
his
taxable.
Question. Yep, always maybe
taxable.
And never.
Yep. He's creating tax diversification.
That have you read this already?
No, I'm just paying attention.
All right, well, because that's what he's talking about.
Yeah.
All right. He's gotten a raise, and he can now max out his 401k. And his question is, should he put more into the traditional 401k or the Roth 401k? He said, I'm in the 25% tax bracket. Mm-hmm. This is before the Trump tax cuts, I would assume, right? Because the 25 is now 22. So I'm guessing he's in the 22 bracket.
Right. The new tax rates didn't hit till 2018. So correct. He wrote this before that.
Well, this is going back in time.
I get it.
It's like a trip down memory lane.
Yeah, it's nice.
See how things have changed?
Mm-hmm. Not much.
Well, taxes have changed. He can now put in $6,000 instead of $5,500.
Well, okay.
He's 2 years older.
Little changes, yeah.
Okay.
Can I say something now?
Or you're
gonna,
I was going to get to his question.
Pile on more?
Well, here's his question. Mm-hmm. I'm in the 25% federal tax bracket and 3% for state and local taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's costing me about $2,500 a year in taxes to do my Roth 401k contributions rather than me putting it in the pre-tax tax-deferred 401k.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on an appropriate level of tax diversification that I should strive for? So in other words, he's trying to see. He gets tax diversification. Why don't you explain the benefits of tax diversification as opposed to 90% of our clients who come to us with the vast majority of the money in always taxable accounts?
Well, the benefits are what we talked about a little bit with the previous caller who called in, which is having the ability to control when you recognize income for tax purposes, control when you recognize gains on investments, when you recognize income as it comes out of your pre-tax accounts like your IRA, your 401k, etc. Having no control over that might lead you to a year where, because of that loss of control, you pay a lot more in taxes than if you could make other choices with recognizing use of your assets, if you will, because these are all assets, of course, of various types. And his early retirement is going to make it, he'll have more years to kind of move things around and do stuff. So that is one nice thing. He's going to have a really big tax planning window. The downside is he's probably going to want to maintain a fairly similar lifestyle to what he has now while he's working. If you don't retire early in order to cut your standard of living in half, few people are willing to make that sacrifice. What they're trying to do is, like, he's shoveling a lot of money away to try to retire early. And so the point is, when he retires, he's not going to be able to live on significantly less. So he's going to have to draw upon accounts. And having that diversity or that diversification of the different types of accounts, the always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable categories, gives you the flexibility. And the more flexibility you have, the better you can react to changes in law, to changes in rules, to changes in your spending behavior. It's under your control. So I like a balanced approach. And something for people to always remember when you're making the decision for a Roth 401k, if your company's matching, their part is always going into a traditional 401k. So even if you elect the Roth 401k choice, you are already creating tax diversification for yourself if there's an employer match of any substance, because theirs cannot go into the Roth part. By law, their contributions, the employer contributions, still have to go into your traditional 401k. So now he's probably putting in a lot more than the match. So he's going to be fairly, the pendulum will have swung
he
for him a
in,
lot more towards the Roth side.
Just so you know, he indicates in his email, now again, with his pay raise, he's going to max out. So I forget what the max was in 2 years ago.
It's like 18.5 or something like that.
2 years ago?
18.
It's like 19 now?
It's 19 now.
So he said he's taking and he's putting equal pots in the traditional 401k and the Roth 401k.
Then his pendulum's a little bit more towards the traditional, because when you take the half he's putting in and then put all of the employer match in there. He's actually putting a little bit more in the traditional. If his intent is to do 50-50.
He is putting $5,500 in a Roth as a contribution.
So he should look at the whole picture and make sure he's accomplishing what he thinks he's accomplishing, trying to accomplish in the form of the tax diversification. But your comment about 90% of people who show up at our door have a vastly unbalanced or non-diversified tax situation because they did what everyone told them to do for decades. Pile up as much money as possible into these deferred accounts. Don't pay taxes on it now. Worry about that later.
Well, they've always said later and, you'll be in a lower tax bracket, yeah, which is bull.
Exactly.
You're not. And that is, I should write a book on financial fallacies.
Old wives' tales.
Old wives' tales. Yeah. Or just the same old crap that the financial press regurgitates because they're journalists and not financial experts. And you keep hearing that you will be in a lower tax bracket. You're not. Now, could someone in the 39.6 be in a lower bracket? Sure. But do you really think they're going to be in the 12 or 15 as it is today? No. You're not going to go from living at a 39.6 tax bracket all of a sudden living on less than 70 grand as a married couple. You're just not going to be doing that. Maybe the 39.6 will be in the 35. But if that person in the 39.6 has been maxing out pre-tax accounts, they're going to be hit with large RMDs mm-hmm. and everything else. I can't say for certain they're going to be in a lower bracket. But for most people listening to this, you're in the 22 or the 28. Well, it's now what is it, 24? I always get confused because the old brackets are coming back in a few more years. But you're in the 22 or the 24 right now, and you're going to be in the 25 or the 28 in retirement. So especially, listener, hopefully you're still listening because you did write this in 2017 and wanted a rather quick reply. But with the Trump tax cuts, it's more promising, I think, to be saving in the Roth. Mm-hmm. Because when he wrote this, he was in the 25. That is now 22. But when he retires, that'll be back to 25. And I personally think in the future, the 25 will probably be the 28, and the 28 bracket will probably be the 32, and so on and so forth, because I think taxes will rise. The guy's only 36 years old right now. Don't think, listener, taxes are going to stay at these levels for the rest of your life. They're probably going to go higher. So I personally, his main question is how much should he have in tax diversification? In a perfect world, people would come through this door with one-third in taxable, always taxable, one-third in maybe taxable, and one-third in never taxable. That would be ideal. Or two-thirds in never and one-third in maybe. But I don't like when people come with 80, 85, 90, 95% and always taxable, or Chris, sometimes 60, 70, 80, 90% and never taxable. And we it's not that we don't like that. We're cautious when we see it because most people are paying far more to get it in. Mm-hmm. And because they've got so much in never taxable, the lower brackets never get used when they start. Everybody thinks, oh, I'd love to retire and just have no taxable income. So I'm going to plow all this money into Roths, even though I'm in the 25 or 28 or 30. Right. And, and what they're not factoring is you're wasting the 10 and the 12, which is going to be 15 when it goes back. You're wasting all of those lower brackets
during all the years you're retired. All those brackets now
exactly.
are underutilized. You'd like to fill those brackets and avoid filling the 22, 25, 28 more or more brackets that you've got. So just because you have a bunch of money in non-tax, now when people show up with that at the door, though, of course, that's water under the bridge.
Yeah, there's nothing we can do about it.
At this point, it's, you know, it's
and we don't even mention it to them.
It's, no, because it's
kicking
point?
Sand in the face, or whatever that's called.
Yeah, you know. By the way, you could
rubbing sand in the wound. No,
salt
in the wound.
Yeah, kicking sand in their face. That would be
no. That's something mean people do.
Well, I know, but that would be the really harsh way of doing it. You're right. Salt in the wound is a lot more appropriate.
Yeah.
But the sand in the face is one thing, and salt in the wound is another.
But they mean the same thing.
No. You're right. The sand in the face is you being a bully.
Yeah.
Salt in the wound is just pointing out, oh, by the way, you're hurt already. Let me rub this in there and make you feel even worse.
But the point is, listener, don't overdo, or any listeners, not just this one, don't overdo tax-free. Your initial knee-jerk reaction is, oh, I want to get it all in a Roth. And that honestly, Chris, was my reaction when Roths first came out. And for years, I just plugged it away into the Roth. Until even I started saying, well, wait a minute here. As I start looking at this, I've got to grow my always taxable pool a little. Because I'm going to be overweight too much. And my brackets are going to go to waste, those lower brackets. So, one third is reasonable, or one third, two thirds is pretty reasonable. But you do want some money in always taxable. What you don't want is 60, 70, 80, 90% in always taxable. And we've seen that, especially 90, 95% in always taxable, because people start to realize when they get there, wow, I'm going to be in trouble when RMDs begin. And then not only that, folks, if you're a married couple, at the death of the first spouse, all that massive IRA is inherited by the surviving spouse. If you guys are close in age, a year or two or three apart, the RMDs are going to be nearly the same size, but the tax brackets are going to be cut in half. So we call that the widow-widower tax penalty. All of a sudden, the widower or the widow is being nailed in taxes because of all this money. And that's what you have to do with tax planning. So anyways, a third is good if we can get that. All right. So he's got a couple more questions related to that.
Well, hopefully not too many more because we're at the end.
Oh, wait, well, I got a couple more questions. Guy's been waiting since 2017.
I get it. Let's make sure we fit him in.
All right. The next question has to do with how to access my funds prior to age 59 and a half. If I can achieve my goal and can retire at 50, I think he's espousing FIRE. Have you ever heard of the FIRE movement? That's where he wants to retire early. I need to bridge the nearly 10-year gap between my age of 50 and 59 and a half when I can access money without the 10% penalty. And one thing I will say, listen, you're only 36 years old right now. A lot is going to change between 36 and 60. You start to make all these decisions based on something that isn't going to happen for 24 years. Don't be surprised when those laws change. Maybe 59 and a half goes away. And it's no longer applicable, or it gets changed to a much older age. Oh, you got to be 65 to access money without a 10% penalty. So just keep that in mind. You're still young. You could be Chris's son, for Pete's sakes. Okay. He lists three things he can do to battle this. He wanted our opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Accumulate more taxable assets. I think he means brokerage accounts.
Yeah, that wouldn't help. But the brokerage account has no strings attached, so you can access that whenever you want. Also, contributions that you put in your Roth are going to be available, so don't ever forget that. You can take that money out anytime, any reason. But if you start harvesting a lot of these accounts out, you have to worry about giving up potential tax-free growth that you could get leaving it in there. So it's all part of the big picture.
Okay. Because he said, what he's saying is he could try to figure out what he's going to need every year between 50 and 59, divert or reduce what he's putting in tax sheltered holdings and instead putting in taxable accounts. And by that, I'm guessing he means brokerage and savings accounts. So that is an option. We're not going to dispute that. That is definitely something he could do. there's issues with it. One of the other things to keep in mind, listen, you don't indicate what you do, but taxable accounts will receive no type of creditor protection or bankruptcy protection. I know you're trying to save up money to retire early, but what if something happens to you? Or what if you end up being sued someday? Your IRA will be protected from bankruptcy under federal guidelines. There are some limits. Those limits are so high, your IRA will probably be protected. Your 401k under ERISA will definitely be protected. So bear that in mind, even though we do like always taxable accounts, if you are, maybe taxable accounts we like, if you are in a profession that is prone to lawsuits, like if you're a physician, I really like that money, Chris, in those cases to be in ERISA-protected plans because they are often sued and it's good to protect those. So do bear that in mind with that. The next thing he asked is he could do 72T payments, substantially equal periodic payments under Section 72T. We received a question recently on 72T, and I should probably answer it. So I'll answer that more on that separate email question. He wants to know what our thoughts of that are. He says he does write, this is my least favorite because it seems to be very inflexible and prone to things going wrong. What should I look out for with a 72T withdrawal program? I'm not going to get into that listening here because, first of all, you're only 36 again. I don't know in 14 years if 72T will be around or even what I'm going to describe about it would even apply. However, you nailed it when you said it is very easy to screw up and it's very inflexible. Mm-hmm. I personally am not a fan of 72T, especially, listener, in your case. If you start doing this at 50, you've got to go 5 years or to 59 and a half, let's call it 60. So he has to go 10 years with this. He's going to be locking himself into a withdrawal schedule for 10 years that may not apply. And if he breaks that withdrawal schedule at all or tries to access additional monies from his IRA or even put more money into said IRA, it can blow up. And the 72T just falls apart. I'm not a fan of it, but if you want to learn about it, listener, there is a guy who's just geeked out on 72T. Go to his website, 72T.net, and you'll learn more about 72T than you ever wanted to know.
Yeah, if you go down that path, I'm not a huge fan as well for the same reasons, but if you go down that path, remember, it could be probably most effectively used as a buffer amount or a foundation amount that you know you're going to want. Let's say your total living expenses are $30,000, but you know you're absolutely in any given year over the next 10, you're 90% sure you're going to need at least 15 of that. You could set up the payments at that level and then fund the rest of it with more discretionary withdrawals have it a way to kind of bolster maybe his brokerage accounts. Maybe they're not big enough to do the whole thing for the 10 years, but create a floor, much like our minimum dignity floor idea with the 72T, and then cap on top of it the more variable stuff that you might have that might come and go. Don't try to guess what your needs are going to be precisely to the dollar every year for 10 years. It's not going to work, but there might be a foundation or fundamental amount that he could use, but I don't think of it that way. If you go down that path, I like how he's not really attracted to it because it's that's a long time to commit to something.
10 years. I've seen especially people commit as young to longer as ones.
Oh yeah, especially so many things can change in your life between 50 and 60.
Mm-hmm. I've seen people in their 40s start this, and I think it's nuts. His final one is one that we haven't talked about, and that's why I wanted to get to this, and I know we have to wrap up. Roth conversion laddering, and he wanted to know what our thoughts on that was. For those who don't know what Roth conversion laddering, well, I'll just read what he wrote, and then you'll get an idea. I'm sure you guys are familiar with this strategy. Basically, I'll make sure to have enough in a Roth IRA as contributions when I first retire, and this money will be sufficient enough for me to last 5 years. During that time, I will continue to make Roth conversions each year from my traditional IRA into a Roth IRA to fund the fifth year and beyond. So you see how that's going to work.
Because the conversions have the five-year lockup in there.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's his strategy. That strategy will work because of the way the ordering rules of Roth IRAs work. Remember, contributions come out first, then conversions, then earnings. So his strategy, folks, would be to make sure his Roths contain, in contributions, enough money to fund the first 5 years of his retirement. Remember, he wants to retire at 50. He wants to retire earlier. He's trying to avoid the 10% early withdrawal penalty, which will take effect at 59 and a half, all of which is based on current laws, and this listener is only 36. So again, we don't know if the rules today will apply to him in the future, but for those of you who are in a similar situation but older than him, his strategy, the Roth conversion strategy, the laddering, does work. And Chris and I don't talk about that much on this because we haven't had a question like this. But what he would do is if there's enough money for the first 5 years to survive by taking Roth withdrawals of contributions, his earnings for 5 years are essentially zero, tax-free. And then during that time period, he starts to convert the amount he would need in year six, he does in 1 year. The money he needs in year seven, he does the second year of retirement. Mm-hmm. In year eight, he does the third year of retirement. So when those years come in, he can now take that money out and not pay a 10% early withdrawal penalty. And by living on just the Roth money, it keeps his tax bracket so low, he can get those conversions taxed at very low rates. So that's how the strategy works. It's a good strategy. I think out of the three, the reason I'm leaning towards that is at least he would get his creditor protection earlier that he's not going to get in the maybe taxable account. But I think the biggest thing that can come bite him in the hiney is law changes between now and then. That's the only thing I'm hesitant on, is that they change the laws. That politicians in the IRS hate strategies like this. And would they ever pass a rule that either extends that past 5 years? You have to be 59 and a half in order to get conversions out without a 10% early withdrawal penalty. So future law changes could blow this strategy up. But someone who's retired now, who has enough money in his Roth as contributions, and you probably did not get it, Chris, as you know, via regular Roth contributions. They've only been around since 98. Even if you maxed out every single year what you could have contributed to the Roth, you might not have enough in there to fund 5 years. And very few people put the max in since 98.
Right.
So there may not be enough to fund that first 5 years. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. I don't know. But any thoughts on the strategy? I like the, I mean, the strategy would work. It's a lot of, it's not for the faint of heart. He seems to have a good handle on finances. Mm-hmm. But if you play by the rules, it works.
Yeah, I'm not a... It seems like he's going to be draining substantial parts of his Roth at such a young age. Where the Roths really shine is when you have all that tax-free compound.
Well, he's only going to drain his contributions. 5 years, supposedly, mm-hmm. just his contributions. Other than that, he's got a 10-year period between 50 and 60. Mm-hmm. For the first 5 years, yes, he's going to drain his Roth early. But for the next 5 years, he's just draining his IRA early.
Correct. I get it.
Out of the three he wanted us to pick, that's the one I would be most attracted to. Although the first one, where he grows his taxable account, is attractive to me as well, if he's not in a career or a line of work that might lead him to being sued.
Let me throw out a curveball.
Okay.
some type of easily obtained or passive income that you can receive during those early years when you're younger, like rental income or who knows what, something you've built online, little business or something like that, that could fund a lot of that kind of stuff. And arguably there is this other investment category that we don't talk a whole lot about on here, which is real estate. So there's, you know, potential. We've talked about, you know, the big ones, the brokerage account, the pre-tax and the post-tax retirement style accounts, but there might be some opportunities there too worth investigating that could, generate cash flow that is not, doesn't have a lot of these tax strings attached to them during those early years, particularly before the 59 and a half period, might be something worth considering if it's of any interest to him at all. If he disdains that, has no interest in it, I wouldn't push somebody into it. But if it's something that he has interest in, worth considering.
It could work if he can get a lot of people's, especially as they first start, though. I like Chris's idea, so I'm not arguing. I would just point out it has to be cash flow positive. And most early purchases of rentals, because of the mortgage payments, they're just about covering their expenses. Or right. Depending on where he lives, all real estate is local. He's in isn't he in Indiana? Was he the Indianian? I think so.
I don't recall.
So I don't know what the rental market in. Yeah, he's an Indianian. I don't know what the rental market is. He may not be able to be cash flow positive enough on it, and then it's not working, and then he loses a renter or two, and now it's cash flow negative.
Oh, yeah, there's lots of there's a lot of downside that goes with
but
that.
But I fully agree. Throwing it out there. Diversify his potential income stream, a passive income stream, might work. But out of the three you listed, I think 1 and 3 make the most sense. I agree with you, listener, and with you, Chris. 72T is just too much of a risk, in my also very humble opinion. Okay, well, we're going to wrap that up on his question. We'll get to the rest. He asked some healthcare questions later. We'll get to that on another show. But, yeah, hopefully he'll appreciate that. Hopefully he's still a listener after nearly 2 years.
Maybe we'll see. Maybe he'll send us a follow-up email. Oh. Give us an update on his status 2 years later. Here's what I decided to do. See how it aligns with what we recommend.
Maybe he'll make us wait 2 years to get his reply.
We'll see. So as we close out here, I want to remind everybody that we are living, breathing, practicing retirement planners in particular. So we refer to ourselves as financial planners, but our niche is really retirement planning, particularly distribution planning and dealing with all of the issues that seem to come up in all these Q&A shows that we do, as well as the EDU shows that we put up as well. We are practicing retirement planners. If you are interested in learning a little more about what we can do for you in your retirement planning situation, we encourage you to reach out to us on our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, HELPS.com. And then there's a contact form you can fill out, send us some information, we'll be in touch with you, or you can even schedule what we call a coffee and a second opinion, which is a free introductory meeting where we talk a little more in depth about your situation and exactly what we can do in cases like yours. So unlike a lot of places, we're not looking to, you don't have to bring your assets to us to work with us. We charge for our services, so fancy that. We supply a variety of services, including just a full-blown retirement plan and other things, but we can talk about that a little bit more if you call, if you're interested. So thanks a lot, everybody, for listening, and we'll be back next year. Not next year.
Next year?
Yeah. I'm already jumping to the end of the year. Back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-970-970. 530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.